That'll be useful. Just like the favor, right? All right. So I think the last time I stopped, I gave some examples as to how to use that in the case of ion scattering, where you had some interactions which have derivatives. Just for Wilson bosons, these interactions always have derivatives. Later on, I'll want to show you how you calculate what the coefficients are in the various kinds of interactions. But the point of the exercise last time, and like particle-particle scattering, where you chose what E was, and by asking how you systematically get the lowest power Q divided by something, you were told exactly what graphs you had to do. And so in particular, for that example, I showed you leading contribution came when you had no loops, so L was zero, and you chose only interactions with two derivatives, and you have as many as you like, because that just shouldn't at all. When you do that, the result was more than Q squared. And the subleading term went like Q to the fourth, and it came from either using the same interactions at the one loop level, or working again at the classical level with L zero, allowing yourself exactly one vertex where E was equal to 4. And as many vertices as you like for D equal to 2. And the upshot was that you had a rule for taking the general effect of Lagrangian that we start off with and identifying how the scales of the problem were appearing in any order of loop expansion. So given that, suppose somebody hands you an effect of Lagrangian. How are you supposed to calculate the effect of Lagrangian? So the first thing you're supposed to do is just decide how accurate you want your answer. So for example, in the second case, we wanted the amplitude for the cross sections to be 1%. We know that loops are being suppressed by ratios of scales. The energies, Q was the energy of particles in the low energy theory, and it was being divided by some big scale. And so, effectively, perturbation theory was being controlled by the low energy approximation. So then we have to decide what power is identified. Mean power is a small thing, Q over M, or whatever the thing is you need or required to achieve this accuracy. Then you use your handy-dandy power cutting formula. Or the one that's appropriate for your theory, it's not for your theory, it's just one of these over there. Identify which effective interactions disorder. And the example I used last class, I chose an example where there happened to be an infinite number of interactions that could appear at the lowest order, because we were allowed to use any classical interaction involving two derivatives. In principle, we could have had an arbitrary number of those, because we could have had a phi squared d phi d phi term, or a phi to the fourth d phi d phi term, and so on. As long as you could draw a tree-level graph, you're allowed to use it. And what restricted you was, for a fixed process with fixed number of external lines, the restriction that you were drawing a tree graph told you where to stop in the number of interactions you had. So you couldn't have something with 70,000 scalar fields in it, because if you're calculating before two particles, but two particles here, E equals four. Because you can't draw a tree graph without a vertex, without any external lines. But if you're interested in all possible processes, so all possible values of E, in that particular example, there'd be any number of elements you have to worry about at this step. Well, typically, you're not interested in all possible processes. In that particular example for pions, it's true that symmetries tell you what all those couplings are, so it's not that you need more chance to. You still have something you can predict. So, step four is right below. Step four has two parts, depending on what you know about the full theory. Part 4a, this is a, if you know microscopic theory, so for example, if you knew in our theory of two scalar fields, the theory with the heavy scalar and the light scalar, which is the microscopic theory, whereas the effective theory, which would not be integrating out the heavy particle, was the one just involving the light scalar, and that was the one for which we used this power counting analysis. And what you should do if you know the full theory, and you can calculate with it, so, for example, you know that the couplings in that theory are weak, because we were calculating things in perturbation theory, typically, with the example I looked at. So if you can calculate things and know what the theory you're dealing with, then what you need to do is identify calculate what these effective couplings are that you need for your answer as functions of the real parameters. So, matching. Which of the effective couplings you need for the axis you want to work, then you go and calculate what they are from the fundamental theory and then your business, because you can calculate the process you're trying to calculate for the axis you want to calculate it. There were some finite number of interactions you need to know that you've calculated the assumptions of the masses and the underlying theory, and then you're done. That's a very efficient way to calculate the low energy process, involved much more efficient than just taking the full theory, calculating the scattering you're interested in, and at the end of the day, taking the low energy limit. But what makes this really useful is that it might be that you either don't know what this fundamental theory is, or you know what it is, but you can't calculate with it because it's in a strongly coupled regime. So, if the microscopic theory is unknown, you can still say something, and what you can do is you can just, as long as you calculate more things than you have parameters, what you have to do in this case is you can't calculate these. You can do the first three steps, but if you can't calculate or you don't know what the fundamental theory is, you can't figure out what these parameters are that the answer depends on. It doesn't mean you can't say anything. What it means is that if you have, supposing there were four parameters you identify this way, as long as you can calculate five things involving those four parameters, you get to make one prediction. Because four of those things you'll just take from the experiment. You'll infer the value of the parameters from experiment. But then the fifth one you'll know, because now you know all the parameters. So you can still say something in this case, provided that you are using more observables than you have parameters that you identify in part three. So, obtain the required parameters. So in the case of the plans that I used as the example last time, there was one parameter that was relevant to the order, leading order, and that was this fpi parameter. And I told you, but I didn't show you why, that you could obtain that by calculating the decay rate for pions into leptons, and it turns out that the decay rate is controlled by that parameter. So you can infer the value of that parameter, 93 MeV, from the lifetime of the pion. Once you have it, then you can go over and calculate all the pion scattering length, because all the scattering amplitudes are being predicted by the same parameter. So that's an example where, in that case, you knew what the underlying theory was, and in that case, the underlying theory for pions was in QCD, quarks, and gluons. The problem was you couldn't calculate the properties of the pion from it because those are some complicated bound state, maybe the quarks and gluons. So in that particular example, you had to use 4B because you couldn't calculate the first principles from the underlying theory, things you needed to know. But you could still make predictions because you had more things to predict than you had parameters to describe them with. And how many parameters you have depends on step one, how accurate you want to work, but there's always a finite number of them. So if, as long as you're working to some finite accuracy, you get to stop somewhere, and there's a finite number of parameters that you identify in step three, and then that's the tells you how many parameters you need, how many observables you need in step 4b in order to make headway. And you can kind of see that the logic of 4b is very much like the logic of a renormalizable theory. For renormalizable theories, you would have, like QED, you would have said that I don't know the electric charge of the electron, I don't know the mass of the electron, but I go out and calculate everything in an atom as a function of those two things. I take those two things from experiments, maybe electron scattering or something, and then once I've done that, then I predict everything else. So the logic of 1 to 3 with 4b is very much what you do with renormalizable theories. And this is showing you that, that there's nothing special about renormalizability in that logic, that, that the theory of pions I gave you was not renormalizable in the sense it had interactions that, that had couplings you can mention and numerous powers of mass. And we can still do this, this procedure and have something predictive at the end of the day, even though it's nominally renormalized. And renormalizable, so having said that, you can kind of see why renormalizable interactions are, why they come up so often. So a special case would be if we only need step two for zeroth order and one over m. See what that means over here. This is the effective theory so which one is led in step four, so for step three, is normalized. So what does that mean? Renormalizable, I've been taking it to mean if you had some interactions, so you had the letter M, which was EV5, and you started looking at interactions, so you had M squared, pi squared, 2, you might have had G, M5 cubed, and lambda 5 fourth. This would have been a renormalizable theory, because all of the coupling constants here, the coefficients in front of these powers of the field, have dimensions of positive powers of mass. This one is are non-negative powers. This is mass squared, this is mass, and this is dimensionless. If I had written something like, you know, 5 to the fifth times k, let's say, if k would have had dimensions of 1 over mass, because remember the whole Lagrangian has that dimensions of mass to the four dimensions. Because the action is the integral d4x of that, d4x is 1 over mass to the 4th, and the action is dimensionless, d squared is 1, homogeneous. Since the field has dimensions of mass, because mass of derivative squared is mass to the 4th, then this is mass to the 5th, so this has some dimensions of 1 over mass. Something with dimensions of 1 over mass is a coupling constant. That's the thing that was called not normalizable historically. And it was not normalizable because on dimensional analysis grounds, if we had done the same kind of argument here and asked, how did graphs diverge? So instead of following the CLQ, the route following financial regulation, we've regulated everything to the cutoff, we follow the common cutoff here. You get worse and worse, you get divergences for different graphs with lots and lots of loops for fixed, different numbers of external lines. They all diverge at some point. If I have a coupling, which is on dimensional grounds, I'm going to have a mass to the power, and I stick it a million times into a graph, but on dimensional grounds, I'm going to have the answer will have to be multiplied by a million more powers at the cutoff, if I'd asked how things depend on the cutoff, that it would have done if I didn't use that interaction. And that's kind of basically the problem with non-normalizable theories, that everything diverges if you pull far enough along the loop expansion. So normalizability, the way they would have talked to you about it in the 60s, would have just been couplings of inverse dimensions of inverse powers of mass. But you can kind of see why, if we're working in this framework, the zeroth order in the small thing, Q over M, from this last formula, you can kind of see why we're being led to for normalizable in that sense. Because if I think of F, V, and M are large scales that are all much bigger than Q. So from that point of view, this thing involves two large scales, and so it's not really a suppression Q or something. This is that V over M, so that's two large scales. This is the M squared over F squared, that's two large scales. The only thing that involves the light scale and the heavy scale, this way running, is this thing. And you see that the only time if you're working to zeroth order, you're asking for this power to be non-negative. And so, since the number of vertices is up to you, that's a non-negative thing, you're being forced to choose vertices that always have the number of fields involved or the number of derivatives, with some of them to be less than or equal to 4. I said that wrong, it should be non-negative. If you want to go work to zeroth order in this, then we don't want to have a suppression of this, so we don't want this to be positive. This is the statement I want to make. This is positive, so this has to be non-positive, n plus d minus 4. So that says that the number of derivatives plus the number of fields has to be at most 4. And over here, there's the number of derivatives here is 2, number of fields is 2, and some of those things is 4. So n plus d equal to 4 here. 2 fields, no derivatives, that would be 2, that's less than 4. 3 fields, no derivatives, so 3 is less than 4. 4 fields, no derivatives, is 4. So these are all satisfying the Fritsch criterion that would be led to. But 5 fields, and no derivatives is one for which this sum is positive, and so then you're punished by having that big mass non-linear. So if you're working to zeroth order in a small thing, that's the special case that picks up a normalizable theory as the thing that you're going to describe everything with. And so the parameters you'd be led to in part 3 would be the normalizable parameters. So in this case, so using this in 4b is the usual case. It's the usual way you calculate the normal. There's a finite number of parameters because it's normalizable. And you fit those from an experiment, and then everything else you get to predict. And in the old days, if you'd have been around in the 60s, God forbid, then, you know, someone said, they used to think that normalizability was really ugly because you're canceling divergences, because that looks like it's crazy. But the one thing that was good about it, and that's why they held their noses and did it anyway, was that it was predictive. That if you actually, that criterion gave you a finite number of parameters with which you could then predict other things. When you did that with quantum electrodynamics, it worked really well. And so nature seemed to be using normalizable theories, was the logic, even though they seemed like they stunk. This is showing you why it works. That any time in nature, there's nothing special about normalizable theories from the point of view of having a finite number of parameters in predicting, as this technique, you know, this argument, line of argument shows you. The reason that they had thought in the old days that non-normalizable theories were not predictive is that they implicitly, in step one, we're saying they want to work to arbitrary accuracy. And if you're working to arbitrary accuracy, you have to work to all orders of this Q of RAM, so then there's an infinite number of parameters you have to figure out. So then you don't predict anything if you don't know how to calculate the parameters. So the party line complaint about non-normalizable theories falls into this discussion, but it's because you ask for an unreasonable thing and they have to pay that way. Yeah.
So the non-renown level theories are, there's this assumption that there's more massive degrees of freedom that you just don't know about or can't parameterize in any way. I mean, if you captured all the degrees of freedom in your fundamental theory, then you'd expect to have a renormalizable theory. Is that?
Yeah, that's what this would say. This says that if you have a hierarchy of scale in your problem, so you have a ratio like Q of Remnant that is small, then if that's a small enough ratio that for all your purposes you can work a zeroth order in that ratio, then the theory that describes the physics you're looking at, you know, will be renormalizable, and you can prove it this way. And so if you turn that around and say, and what you're asking is so the party line now would have been that if you have a non-renormalizable theory, the only known way to use it, to calculate anything, is this description. And so that's what that's telling you is that the power counting step is telling you that it's, you can predict with a non-renormalizable theory, but the only way of making controllable predictions with it, where you actually know how big the things are that you are neglecting, is through a low energy expansion, because what's necessarily controlling your approximations is just low energies compared to the scales of your problem. So because your predictions are all relying on a low energy approximation, that's telling you that you're expecting something to happen when, if you went to high enough energies where Q of ramp was 1, this will not be the description. Something else will have to be the description. And in every case that we know, when you do have a good description, at the energies that are relevant to you, that's described by renormalizable theory, and that's consistent with the statement that all you've really done is you said that if you've identified all degrees of freedom relevant to one scale, the next scale up was far enough away that you didn't even know what it was. And so that's why renormalizable theory is working. And so the picture we have is that whenever you have the right number of degrees of freedom to describe the energies relevant to you, it will be renormalizable. And it's not a theorem, it's just that's the only known way to calculate anything points to that direction.
So then if you take this argument and use it for gravity or something, where okay, you have a non-renormalizable theory. So the statement is that's okay because there's just higher degrees of freedom, like strings or something.
That's okay as long as you're low energies.
Yeah, that are not important at low energies, but yeah, are controlling that. So,
right.
Unless, of course, there's like some asymptotic safety thing about gravity. Is that a different issue?
No, that's just, I think you fall into the same. Asymptotic safety is more to do with the thing I'm doing now, which is you know, when I'm doing all this, I'm counting dimensions in a weak coupled way. I'm just using dimension analysis, and the asymptotic safety issue is if you it can happen that when you look at the dimension of a field, like, I'm counting dimensions as if you mean to read them off the fields here. But really, if you actually ask the dimension of a field, it's not necessarily mass, it's mass of some power which is close to 1. It's not exactly 1, so there's anomalous dimensions for metal that operates. And so once you have anomalous, so given that you can have anomalous dimensions, how things scale will not be quite obvious, or quite the same as you would have thought if you had counted dimensions the way I'm counting. As long as you count them correctly, then they're going to make it work. And that's kind of safety would be the case where the dimension counting is really interesting because the, one way, if you take, remember back to the exact renormalization group story, when I was doing vector axes, one way of saying this renormalizable statement here is that in coupling constant space, if you took all the infinite number of couplings that you have in the spectral Lagrangian, and you go down to low energies, what happens is that you all the possible couplings tend to flow onto some lower dimensional subsurface, and those are that's the subsurface of the renormalizable interaction. Because as you make the effect that the theory, the physics that you've removed higher and higher and higher in mass, you're making these powers more and more and more relevant. So you can work to zeroth order in them effectively. And so there's only a finite number of parameters that are relevant, and those are the ones that are on the surface. And asymptotic safety is the same kind of a statement. It says that as you go off into the ultraviolet, you have predictive power because you end up sitting at a special, in a special surface of like constant space. And so if that's true, that would be as good as our life. So that's why it's attractive. But it would be, it wouldn't be, this is just not an obvious surface because the dimensions are kind of funny, maybe because you're at the funny scale.
So if there was asymptotic safety, then you wouldn't have, that would mean that there wouldn't necessarily be this higher energy states of gravity that we just haven't seen yet.
You wouldn't know. It's,
you wouldn't know.
Just like if someone gives you a normalizable theory, you don't know.
Right.
You've got some parameters and you don't know where they came from.
Yeah.
All the cases we know of with normalizable theories, that was something which was the lunar limit of something else. And you were ignoring powers of one over that something else. On the string theory side, the one way of phrasing what's remarkable with string theory is that all you really would ask for of gravity is that once you get to the energies that are high, where this argument breaks down, you know, where the normalizable predictions of gravity are breaking down, all you really ask is that you get something normalizable again, and there may be something going on at even higher energies that you don't understand, but that you have to understand everything once to understand gravity. But what's remarkable is that there's an example of string theory where you can do controllable calculations to see that it's normalizable, but it's also just strictly finite. So in that case, it could actually, what's remarkable there is first that it's a candidate for something which could have been normalizable for gravity, but it has the property that it could actually make sense all the way down. And that's the first time that's ever happened, and it's about the second time. It's the first time in gravity that's ever happened. It doesn't mean that that's right or that's the only theory that'll do that, but it's kind of remarkable that gravity seems to have that property. So the bottom line is that normalizable theories, this whole picture explains why normalizable theories are seem to be everywhere in nature. It's because nature comes to you with hierarchies of scale. You don't need to understand them all at once. And if you've identified all the degrees of freedom relevant to a scale, this argument shows you that that theory, the theory that describes what you've seen, will be normalizable because that's just the statement that the next scale up is so far away that you can neglect all powers of 1 over whatever it wants. Okay?
This one all over this is all loop levels.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. I'm making, because the thing is that how many loops you go to is implicit in this choice here. So if you're actually going to be a part in 10 to the 8 or something like that, then you'd have to work for some order of loop expansion to get that accuracy. So you'd be doing, this is not a classical argument, it's a loop argument, but how many loops you need will depend on how accurate you want to work. But the statement about the normalizable theories is that you can see that in this case, the loops aren't counting Q over M, the way I've written here. So that if you had a normalizable theory, then it's true that you're all loops in the normalizable couplings are equally unsuppressed by this heavy mass that it was. But you know that you don't have to worry that there's some 18,000 loop graph where I get one of RAM somewhere, because as long as you power count it properly, you know how all the particular path boundaries are going to be. And so what would happen in something like QED or QCD would be that the first thing you did was implicitly a one over mass expansion, but because you stopped at zero order, you didn't see everything, but it was implicit to what you're doing. And then in QED, you can make it explicit. You can say that the muon, if you integrate out the muon in real life, QED with electrons was the effective theory for that. And so you're assuming that the muon is, you're neglecting the powers of the electron mass to affect the muon mass. So the thing is that once you've worked, you identify that you're working to zero order in that expansion, you still have the dimensionless coupling, E, to work with. And so then, to fix order in the energy expansion, you need to go to all orders and equals. And then there's a separate issue completely is how you approximate the dimensionless couplings, or the positive power mass couplings.
At what point does this break down? You said that you have to have more graphs than you do basically parameters, right?
Or when is it not useful?
Yeah, when is it exactly? Yeah, when is it not useful?
It would not be useful if for example, in this case of supposing we were interested in pine scattering, and for whatever reason we knew that the branch I gave you last time, I don't remember what that branch was, but it was some function of phi squared times d phi d phi, where f, you know, f was 1 plus, you know, some, you know, c to phi squared. Supposing it were true that these triplets were all, there was nothing which told you where they were.
Yeah.
For plans, for Goldstone bosons, it turns out that the symmetry, that if you know the symmetry breaking pattern for which these are Goldstone bosons, then you know where all these triplets functions actually determine for you. But if you didn't, then power cutting, that you know, if you wanted to work with some accuracy, the leading contribution by this argument was the one for which you take as many interactions as you like with two derivatives, that's all of these interactions. But these are, none of them are suppressed compared to the other ones at the energy expansion, so you need to know all. If you're looking at all possible observables, if you're looking at a specific scattering amplitude, you only need a couple of them, but if you want to know all possible scattering amplitudes, then you need to know them all. And so in that case, you would be very interested.
Okay.
Okay. Alright, so let me do QED as a simple example, because there's two things I want to do with a QED example. I want to take some concrete example where you actually have the vector theory and the coefficients can be calculated, and you can explicitly carry this process through and see that it's reproducing things properly. And that's going to have two implications. One will be, One question will always be, if you're thinking of gravity, for instance, what are these scales? What's the scale at which this fails? And in gravity, your naive choice is probably the Planck scale, because that's the scale of gravity. And I want to argue when I get to gravity that that's actually not the scale at which this thing fails. And you'll first see why that happens in this QD example, that it's the lightest scale that becomes the most important, typically, for these effective interactions, not the heaviest scale. And the second thing I want to show you is the how to make the normalization group work. In particular, there's a very convenient choice of a way to normalize the coupling constants, which has all the advantages of dimensional normalization, but also has the advantage that heavy particles that couple from the running of things in a way that doesn't happen in most attractions. And that's implicit. When people talk about how things are running, they're implicitly using this thing that I haven't defined yet. This decoupling. So let's do let's call it the very low energy limit of the standard model. I also want to say something about stimulus. So the standard model has rapid particles, but the ones that are really, really light. So the light, so let's say very low energy means energy is less than or equal to the muon mass, which is about 105, I guess. So the particles that are lighter than that, so the muon, that's the heaviest one. So its mass would be, so let me just keep up the masses here. Mass is 5 b electron. Mass is about a half and then b. 5.11. And there's three neutrinos, possibly more. I don't know what their masses are, but they're not zero, not all zero, and they're at most about an electron volt or so. So they're between zero and about say 10 electron volt. There's a photon. let's. There's a graph on it. I would say when I say the standard model, I mean the standard model is the way people normally talk about it, together with general relativity. And so there should be an effective theory. And the next guy that's more massive than this, the first guy that we ignored, is the next lightest, is the pion. And its mass is like 130 or 140 MeV. So it's not a whole bunch heavier. So I'm going to be more interested in thinking of, I'm going to be thinking of the muon as the heavy thing that we integrate out. It's much, much heavier than the next one down. So we should be thinking that the physics of the muon may not be normalizable to the extent we're trying to neglect powers of the pion mass, which is not so much bigger than the muon mass. But if you're neglecting the muon and the pion mass compared to electron for lower energies than that, then that should be actually a pretty good approximation. So we should expect that for stuff here on down, we're normalizable. It should be a normalizable theory. And the beauty of it is that if you say should be good, you can say how good. And the accuracy to which the renormalizable theory should start to be a problem, just roughly would be something to do, something like the electron divided by the muon mass cos p squared. That's the kind of accuracy that you should be worrying about. And you see that that's a factor of what 100 squared is like 10 to the minus 4. So you're doing things in 10 to the minus 3 level at energies of the electron mass, then that should all be described pretty well by the normalizable theory. And so we can write down the delta v because we know what all the fields are. We know what it means to be normalizable. So normalizable. It has to be consistent with the symmetries. So it's going to be, you know, so the fields involved would be we'd have an electron field, we have a neutrino field, three neutrino fields, we have an electromagnetic field, a mu, and we have a graviton field. Enter. And there's a story with metrics going on. Why don't we ignore the metrics you're off with? Because so the normalizable theory would be if you take the we have kinetic terms all around, so we have so let me say the kinetic term for graviton, which I'm deliberately being vague about. So let me be a little bit less vague. If you imagine expanding around flat space, we have some field h mu nu. The metric would be h mu nu divided by n prime. The difference between the metric and flat space. Then there would be a kinetic term for h, which I can write down, but it's not going to be so big. It's not a spherotic h. We have a kinetic term for everybody else, so that's the photon kinetic term with the usual Maxwell. Kinetic terms for all the fermions would be the usual ones that have qri, u slash u, and they have masses as well, so we're looking. Electron would have a similar story. It would have b slash minus pi. This is so far everything is normalizable. Yeah, this coupling here is dimensionless. Because remember, the way you decide if it's dimensionless or not is you ask what's the dimension of the field. To do that, you know that you need to know what the kinetic terms are. So the kinetic term here, at the end, is the usual curl of A. So the Lagrangian has to be dimensions of mass to the fourth and four dimensions. Derivatives are mass to the one. So F has to have dimensions of mass squared. So F squared would have dimensions of mass to the fourth. But if F is mass squared, derivative is mass, that means A has to be mass, it's like a scalar field. So that's that A is mass. Slash here means, you know, D slash is a gamma mu, the mu where does gamma play drag matrix, K slash is maybe. These gamma matrices are dimensionless, they're just matrices. The kinetic term for the fermionic fields, the same argument says that the dimension of a fermionic field is mass to the 3 halves because two of them would be mass cubed, one derivative would be mass to the 4th, and that's the dimensions of the prime. So because there's only one derivative, these things have to have different dimensions than the bosons, where there's two derivatives in the kinetic term. So we can check that these guys then have dimensions of mass. That's good. And then we can also check that that's dimensionless because this is mass to 3 halves, mass to 3 halves. Together that's mass cubed, that makes it mass to the 4th, and that's dimensionless. So far it's normalized well. This particular choice of where A comes in is function gauging variance. So there's a symmetry under which delta A goes to a gradient at the psi is a and delta mu 0. So this symmetry, this omega is an arbitrary parameter, which is a function of x. So this symmetry is the reason why A is only appearing in this particular curl form, because if I ask what f does under this transformation, it it's invariant because two derivatives are symmetric. It's also the reason why the these terms are appearing together, this derivative and this A, the relative appearance here is going to be fixed by E, where it's the same E appearing here, because that's the only combination which is invariant under this symmetry. And there's no A's in here, because we didn't let the new transform into symmetry. So that symmetry has to be there for reasons that I haven't explained, but it's any massless spin one particle has to have a symmetry like this. But given that we had to make an effective theory which was normalizable and during the symmetry, this is the only thing you break down.
Couldn't you also put a dual, like F times F dual?
Oh, sorry, true, you can write that out in the last. That's right. Theta, it's not being I didn't write that down because that's a total group. I plug this into this. I can write this as being D mu, epsilon mu, A lambda rho, A nu, B lambda, A rho. So that's why in the formula right now, I'm trying to write that down. But you're right to think about whether it's there or not, because in quantum chromodynamics, it's also true you can write it as a total derivative. There's extra terms here. There's an A term and F. So it's a little bit less obvious, but it's still true that you can write it as a total derivative. But it's true in that case that there are field. Remember, total derivatives we're allowed to throw away as long as we never care about boundary conditions. But what happens in the case of quantum chromodynamics is that field configurations come in topologically distinct sectors, and they're distinguished by the boundary conditions. So that means that this term for quantum chromodynamics sees the difference between the different topologically distinct sectors. So it counts the topology of what's going on. So even though it's a total derivative, you're asking questions that care about boundaries, so it contributes. In quantum electrodynamics, where you're doing perturbation theory, it turns out that there's no issues like that. So we pitched out, but it's not an obvious thing that you have to go through a round of arguments to say that it's not.
This is in two dimensions that term would be important, right? Because of the same topological reason.
Say it again.
If it was in two dimensions, because then you have maybe a big map P1 to S1 the back in two dimensions, or?
Oh, there is topology in two dimensions, but it's not measured by this. It would be in two dimensions, you'd have a metric tensor. This would be a disadvantage because you can't have an isometric thing. But these are taken.
Oh, right, yeah.
But there'd be something like this. That would be a topological graph.
Okay.
And then you can have the same, but you know, you have to worry if it's called J now. So I'm not going to write that, but it's true that there's an argument here that I was speaking of. So what's interesting with this is that this describes everything we know about gravity, neutrinos, electrons, and photons really, really well. this theory is really, really successful. So the first step thing is that this is the most general generalizable theory with this part of content. It's subject to the gate entries. This is the gate symmetry here. What I'm not saying explicitly is that there's a similar symmetry for the spin 2 field, which has to be there. And if you would ask, how is it going to couple, the answer would have been general, make it generally covariant. And all the interactions you would have talked about would be non-normalizable. So the only normalizable interaction of the graviton to everybody else, given its gate invariance, is no interaction. So this tells you something. First of all, since this is the most general thing that can work for that part of the content and these slow symmetries. But the fact that works so well, point two is that this is really successful. It's a really successful description. Experiments at these energies. And that includes all of atomic physics, for instance. You know, all of condensed matter physics principles is in here. This may not be the efficient way to think about it, but this is a really good description of what the interactions you would need in lower energies, right? Everything we know is consistent with them coming from this Lagrangian. So the description, the important thing, the only really non-trivial interaction is this one. This is the electromagnetic interaction of with electrons to protons. If we're for atomic physics, you need to have protons in here too, which I haven't talked about, but it would be good if you had a proton. There's a conceptual point there because I'm phrasing this as that we should be talking about low energies compared to muon mass. Like protons are much heavier than muons. Protons are like a 930. So you could say, well, so why are you keeping protons in low energy quantum theory when you would have room for the higher mass? If you keep muons. And the answer there is that we're allowed to, so far I've talked about effective theories as if we're forced to keep everything that's at low energies and nothing else. And there's one extra thing we can do. The reason that we're keeping things at low energies is that if you start at low energies, energy conservation will forbid you from getting anything that's not at low energies. So it's self-consistent. But you can also do, that way of saying it tells you that if you wanted to, you could also define a low energy theory, which is the low energies consistent with a fixed value of some conserved charge. So you could say, I'm going to look at the electrically charged, electric charge equals 6 sector of thermodynamics. And if I start at low energies with that much charge, I will, because of charge conservation and energy conservation, I'll always stay at that charge. And so it'll be a self-consistent description of that physics. So I will capture this kind of thing. And so if I had taken area number, which is a conserved quantity that protons carry, as one of the charges I'm fixing, I can have some fixed number of protons, neutrons, in my low energy theory. And because they're stable, if I start with them, they don't go away. And they don't ruin my low energy approximation if they've been unstable. And if I started with a proton that was actually at rest, so it wasn't carrying a lot of energy, it could decay into something which is light and have lots of energy, and that would ruin my low energy approximation. But because the proton is the lightest thing that carries a conserved charge, carrying number, if I take a bunch of it has to be stable because there's nothing it can decay into, because it would have to, whatever it decayed into, would have to have a carrying number and be lighter than it, and there are none. So it's got to be stable. And then that means that even though it's heavy, I can keep it in low energy theory because I won't get more or less than because the barrier number conservation is 12k. So they'll just sit there. So the energy that's in the mass of the proton will never be released because it'll never decay. And all I have to talk about is the kinetic energy of the proton, which can be light and small. So there's a consistent story you could tell if you wanted to keep the proton, so keep the proton, and I just get the proton. That's not the story I want to tell. So this is very successful.
Sorry, it's a nice question. I don't understand why you think gravity can be like other things.
It's a particle. Yeah. It's why would I not do it?
See,
Simplest experiment you can do. You're thinking, do we see gravity waves? I would say that there's evidence for gravity waves, and fiery pulsars are the evidence that, that we know that orbits decay in a way that's consistent with the radiation. It's true that we haven't actually seen one graviton or seen a gravitational wave in a detector on Earth. But I would say that the fact that we know gravity exists, and there's a very general argument it's an infinite range force, coupled to energy, and pretty much the only thing that can do those things is a massless spin 2 particle. And if it's a massless spin 2 particle, then just Lorentz invariance and unitarity says it has to have its cage invariance, so that loops, which is jump to variance quickly. And so then you're stuck with this, then Einstein's relativity is it.
So.
And there's no problem with
Bernoulli's
infinity.
No, well, in the sense that there's never a problem, I can predict anything I want to. It's just, it's. But the interactions are all non normalizable. So since I told you I was going to write down only the normalizable interactions, so I didn't write down any for gravity. That was why. So that was the thing I was going to say is that. So two things that are, you know, what's different about these particles, the electron and the photon interact with each other, the neutrino and the graviton basically don't interact as far as we know. But they do interact, but they very, very, very weakly. The neutrino, you know, 10 billion neutrinos are passing through every square centimeter from the sun right now, right here, and you don't know that because they don't interact very much. And gravity, you know, you saw it crack the chalk, but it was because the whole freaking Earth was pulling on it. And if you had some very feeble force like the magnetism, you could balance the whole Earth with a very small thing. And so gravity is incredibly weakly interacting. Neutrinos are incredibly weakly interacting. And this is why. You know, if this is the particle content and these are the symmetries, then given that there's no other particle until point high energies compared to this, whatever the interactions were, they'd have to be normalizable, and there aren't any. So it's a huge success of everything. That gravity and neutrinos are so weakly coupled, because if they weren't weakly coupled, something would be wrong. And so, all I put in this is a very basic thing. It's the particle content and the symmetries to do with massless high spin particles. So, and Lorentz invariance and unitarity.
Isn't there another assumption that you're in a weak field limit of GR? To talk about graviton and spin 2 particles.
Very weak.
Yeah.
You can measure it, you know how much fine it is.
No, I know, but that's still an assumption. Which is true here, yeah.
So the fact that this works really well here is a success.
Yeah.
Because it's true that gravity, it doesn't say that this is going to describe gravity everywhere.
Yeah.
It's true. Like gravity is weak, and neutrinos interact weakly, and that's consistent with everything we know about. They could not do it. What's powerful? So the, what I wanted to say here was that. This explains why gravity and neutrinos interact weakly at low energies. It doesn't say that fundamentally they have to interact weakly. It just says that at low energies, they can't interact weakly. All their interactions have to be non-normalizable. So they have to be suppressed by some scale. The question of what that scale is. How weak will depend on what that scale is that suppresses these interactions. Turns out that for neutrinos, it's being suppressed by neutrino interactions have to be described by some thing with dimensions of inverse powers of mass. It turns out to be the Fermi constant, which is 10 to the minus 5 GeV to the minus 2, so it's inverse mass squared. Graviton interactions, it's Newton's constant, which is 10 to the minus 18 GeV minus 2, that's 8 times Newton's constant. So gravity is weaker than neutrinos in a quantitative way, but the qualitative statement is that it's because they're both suppressed by energy divided by mass scale. It's not like there's a dimensionless coupling that's really, really feeble for gravity, like there was a dimensionless coupling for electric magnetism. So what's beautiful about this, this is one of the best things in theoretical physics. So I'm glad I got to tell you it. Unless you probably knew already, but instead, you know, it used to be that Einstein kind of thought that he had options in making up his theory, or Maxwell thought that he had options in making up his theory, or that neutrino, you know, Fermi thought he had options in making up his theory. Now we understand that actually just basically quantum mechanics and special relativity, well, that's invariance, together with the statement of the particle content that we see in the energies, and then very general arguments, tells you what the most general interactions are that these things could have. And that's what we see. If I'd extended the looked at the interaction sector and demanded that it be invariant in the symmetries, I could have derived general relativity here, whole Einstein's whole action. So Maxwell's equations, which is a huge success, and Einstein's equations, which are a huge success, are really inevitable once you've chosen the particle content. So there's a sense in which we understand now that the laws of nature that we found so far are really inevitable, given very, very broad assumptions. And the standard model itself, later on, you'll see, has the same property, that it's a longer list of particles, but once you've got that list, if you've asked, it's kind of an ugly list, there's lots of particles, there's lots of charges, and you might have thought that, who would have chosen that? But one thing you have to give it that's undeniable, that's attractive, is that given that particle content and the corresponding symmetries like this gauge invariance, the most general thing that's normalizable, and so which would be appearing at low energies, is the standard model. It's kind of the definition of the standard model. It's the most general normalizable interactions of these particles. And so there's a very deep sense in which we understand why the standard model is true, given that those particles are around it. So that's a good thing from the point of view of understanding why electromagnetism works so well. It's not like, Maxwell's brother could have had a slightly different theory that was going to work almost as well. There was really general principles telling us that given the inputs of the particle contents, that there's not a lot of results that can be right. Standard models like that. The success of the standard model is telling you that whatever the particles are, they're not same. They're not interacting very strongly, or the scale involved is large. So the non-normalized. That's fantastic, because it means that the predictions that we make are robust. If you calculate something with quantum mechanics in inside of physics, you don't have to care about who's right in quantum gravity string theory, because it's all irrelevant. It's all stuff that's all completely irrelevant at the energies that are relevant to atomic physics. And so all you need them to get right is that they have a photon and electron in their theory, a proton, and then all of condensed matter physics and atomic physics follows. And that's why you don't get a lot of atomic physicists at gravity conferences. So they don't need to care, and they're not crazy not to care. But it sucks if you are in this building and you're trying to show why loop quantum gravity or string theory or whatever is right, because if you get things roughly right, so you get the right part of the content to get the standard model, you're going to get the standard model in spades, right? So all you can then predict is the values of the constants, like the electric constant, the charge of the electron, or the non-normalizable interactions, or predict there's other particles around that we haven't seen, like. But there's a limited number of ways in which you can be testing. And it's going to be true that nature will hide itself from you as long as the low energy limit is particles we've seen, and only that. Because we understand in a very deep way why the particles we've seen have to interact in the way that we think. So it's a double-edged sword. It's great for understanding why the predictions we make are so robust when we compare to an experiment, but it's bad if you think you know what the underlying theory is and the most part. So now what I want to do is I want to integrate out the electron. So we have, one of these particles is not like the others. This one is, the ones we kept are the electron and on down. This one has a mass which is kind of comparable to gravity. These ones are all relatively a million times smaller. Let's ask, at energy low compared to electron mass, that's what very low energies will mean. What can we say about how neutrinos and photons are correct? Let's figure it out. And there's very general things you can say. So where I'm headed now is I'm gonna talk about what are the possible interactions we could have had, and I'm gonna mostly focus on electrons and photons to start off with, just electrons and photons. But I look at photons scattering and energies at the low electron mass, what can I say about it? And you'll see that we can say some very general things without calculating anything. And then I'll do the matching calculation, and you'll see that that what we find agrees with what you would have gotten in QED. And it'll also show you that if we had done the same exercise that I'm about to do for electrons, if we'd done it for muons, we would have had two contributions, and the electron one wins. And that's going to be the thing that tells you which scale is important in the problem. You know, because if we look at theory below electron mass, you could have imagined when we're choosing our scales like F and G and kappa M in our effective theory, should we use the muon mass or the electron mass in all those things? And by comparing in the QED the implications of both, you'll see why the lighter one is the one that's important to us. And so when you're thinking about gravity, that'll tell you why scales smaller than the Planck scale are almost certainly going to be. It's probably true that the electron mass is the one that's important in the solar system, not the Planck mass. Looking at corrections to the so our, let's take our microscopic theory. That would be QED minus 1/4 F mu F mu minus psi r P slash M psi. D mu is partial mu minus I E mu.
Then your field variation for the fermion should be negative minus.
Yeah. It's not being heard anything I do, but it's just living the system. And then the effective theory. Are we built out of, what are we supposed to do? So we did the renormalizable thing here. So we imagine that we're ignoring 1/m muon effects. The effective theory, what we want to do is just do the, we're writing down something now involving just the photon. It's got to be gauge invariant. So it's got to be built out of F, not A. So I'll have principal light, and I'll have something like what I had here. I'll give myself an arbitrary coefficient here, just call it that. Just didn't have to be the same normalization as this one. It may turn out to be the same, but remember the rule is I'm going to write down everything that's possible consistent with the symmetries, and I'll stick coefficients in front, and I'll later on ask what the coefficients are by matching this line. So this is the coefficient of this third term. What else can I have? I could try to do something with 3s. There's two things. There's several arguments that allow me to get rid of the things involving 3Fs. One argument is that anything involving an odd number of Fs I can get rid of because this theory is invariant under charge conjugation invariance. And under that symmetry, A mu goes to minus A mu. So F goes to minus F. So if this was invariant, then this has to also be invariant. And so that would mean that I'll never get something involving an odd number of Fs because that would not be invariant if it's charge conjugation. There are interactions that I didn't write down here that would have been in the non-renormalizable things coming from higher energies, weak interactions, which will break charge conjugation invariance. So that's the thing I have to worry about it, actually. So that's why there's a second argument. So the second argument is that what can you write down with 3Fs? You could have something like F mu, F mu lambda, F lambda mu, say. That could be a guess for what you could have as a 3F interaction. That's just identically zero if you write it out. And kind of one way to think about that is if you took the matrix F, one index up, one index down, as a matrix, then this would have been mu lambda F lambda mu, which you could think of as being trace of F cubed. If I thought of this being the matrix F with indices, rows, and columns, then this would be matrix multiplication. I take these things to identify them in sum. Then this, I take the final and last index, and I weight them and sum that. That's the trace. But this is an anti-symmetric matrix. So the trace of this is, because F is anti-symmetric, this is a trace of minus F cubed. That's minus the trace F cubed. So it has to be zero because it's minus itself. So this is something which is just identically zero if you try and write it down, even though it looks like it might not be zero. You know, if you had 15,001 Fs, so you had an odd number, but you had a lot of derivatives you could stick in too, you might have worried that this argument could have failed, but then the charge conjugation argument would have just told you, don't keep that one. Okay, so this is something which has got a dimensionless coefficient. If we're supposed to keep only the normalizable things, this is it. There's nothing else I can write down which is normalizable. So that would say that, by and large, if you integrate out the electron, then photons don't do much. And that's true. That's why the microwave background is there, that when the temperatures are high enough that the nuclei and electrons are separated from each other, so you have free charge carriers, electrons, photons scatter a lot. But as soon as everybody becomes neutral, the photons don't scatter much because there's not very much they can do with low energies. And so that's why the universe becomes transparent. The light that's around them is there now, and that's what the microwave background is. That's also why the sun is transparent. The sun becomes opaque as you go inside of it because eventually it's hot enough for electrons to strip so many photons. So that's the first approximation that's true. That's not such an interesting thing yet. But let's ask who the non-normalizable interactions have. What can we write down? Well, we're building things which have an even number of indices, and we get to get rid of them by contracting them with either the metric or the epsilon symbol, with both of which have an even number of indices. So we have to have an even number of, we're going to go up in steps of even powers of dimension. So after dimension 4, F has dimensions of mass squared, so it's dimension 2. F we knew was mass of the fourth, that's what I call dimension 4. The next thing, I can't write into dimension 5, because that would be, there's no way to make a Lorentz invariant thing out of an odd number of derivatives or indices. But at dimension 6, you could imagine writing down something like A1 F mu box. F mu. And box is just partial mu. Or you could have had A2 times partial mu F mu nu partial lambda F lambda nu. And that's all you could. Anything else I could do. I could integrate the parts and make it look like this again. But this actually is not really in there, right? Remember that when I'm writing out the most general interactions I can write down, some of them will be redundant. If I try and actually find what these coefficients are by going to light scattering experiments and comparing what I see with these coefficients, what I would find is that nothing ever depends on A1 and A2. And that's because these are redundant interactions. I'm always allowed to take the lowest order equations of motion and simplify what's left. And anything that vanishes when I use the lowest order equations of motion won't appear in anything physical because I can remove it by field definition by this argument I gave you before in the previous class. So the claim is that both these things can be removed using the equation of motion for the leading part of the action. So the field equations, so this is an aside. So if the zero order rounding is minus 1/4 z f mu f mu, then the variation of the action with respect to a mu, it's just Maxwell's equations, that would be z factor 4/4 over weight, because the minus sign over 4 weight on the bigger part, so e mu f mu. So the classical equations of motion are that, and so z is a constant, so I can divide by z if I want. So this is the equation of motion I'm allowed to use. So that's clearly, it's clear that this vanishes when I use the equation of motion. It turns out this also vanishes, because if I write over this, remember f mu nu was partial mu a nu minus partial nu a nu. So if I take the divergence to get the thing that vanishes, that's box a nu, because I get partial mu here, minus partial mu nu. So if I now, what I want to claim is that the box of f mu is zero. So the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to take this equation, and I'm going to see this is almost box of f mu nu, but it would become box if I differentiate again and I anti-symmetrize and the indices. So I'll take partial lambda, just, I'll get flux of partial lambda mu minus partial lambda partial mu partial v mu is 0. So now I'll asymmetrize the mu and mu, so I'll subtract my physics to do. And that cancels that because the derivative is just metric, and what's left is just. So that shows you that this thing is also zero. So really nothing is happening here. And we have to go to next order to see them.
So can you just repeat the argument was if you can solve the first order Lagrangian with these equations, you can do a field redefinition that just gets rid of those terms?
Yeah, because basically the statement was if I had an action which was S0, it's a small thing times S1.
Yeah.
Anything in S1 that vanishes with the equation motion of S0, I can remove by doing the transformation phi goes to phi plus epsilon, so the integral would be 4x, S0, phi.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Time literally coefficient was. And if I do this here, work to order epsilon 0, I can cancel off anything that's vanishing with the equation motion. So I can do that if at least it turns out. Because I can remove them from the field redefinition, they won't appear anywhere. And if you don't believe me, what you should do is you should calculate what about scattering once we get it. We're going to get an interaction here with mu's. Put these things in, and you'll see that they don't appear in the answer. So you don't have to be clever to get rid of them. If you're just dumb and you keep them, you'll just see them never appear anywhere. And it might have bothered you if you thought your business was. You know, in step three, I had to figure out what these processes were, and in step four, I had to calculate what they were. You'd say, well, God, you know, if I couldn't calculate them, I could never get them from experiment because nothing ever depends on them. But you don't need to care because nothing depends on them, is the main thing. And this argument is showing you why you never have worked with them. Things will change if we have kind of classical currents around. So there's a source for the electromagnetic field. So I should say that as a caveat. Because I'm going to do this in a second. This is kind of boring if the photons aren't doing anything very interesting yet. So the caveat would be if there are macroscopic currents, macroscopic sources, so some charge densities or some current densities or whatever, these will have to satisfy that they're conserved. So this is satisfying that's equal to zero. So that's the state of the current contribution. Then our Lagrangian would have been minus 1/4 z f mu minus some charge times a mu times j mu. That would be the way a current would interact with the electromagnetic field. And so if we had started with that instead of what I started with, so we were interested in how the electromagnetic field responded to some currents, as you often are when you're doing electromagnetic field. And the only thing that changes here is that instead of this being zero, it would be equal to E times J nu, J nu. And so if we repeat this argument, what we would have found is that so this wouldn't have been zero, it would have been E times partial mu J nu minus partial mu J nu. So these wouldn't vanish anymore, but what they would, I could always write them as being something quadratic in the two J's. So I can always think of this as being a current-current interaction, which is mediated by the electromagnetic field, but it's not giving me photon scattering, say. So whether or not this is irrelevant or not depends on exactly the physics problem. And so this could have been, instead of being zero, it could have been J dependent. It would have been something like J mu, partial mu J mu, partial mu, j mu, in other terms, so I can tell you exactly what the structure was. So if I use this, then the term a, so what I had was a box. That if I use this and this, it just becomes e squared a 1 minus 2a2. So that interaction is just becoming a current interaction. So that's like a Coulomb energy between these have been charged densities with the sort of rho squared. Or current densities with j dot j. Whatever it is, it's independent of the radiation field. So the free wave, it doesn't pair out chemical sources, which is what photons are.
So this would only be possible if there was something that was lighter than the electron that the photons would interact with.
What I'm imagining is it's really some macroscopic. So it's principally, it's some complicated thing built with electrons and protons, some wire or something.
Oh.
And so it's, if you think about when you're really doing Maxwell's equations, you know, working with really electric fields that are macroscopic, you've always got a source like that, which is this giving you a field, some charge distribution or some. And so that's some complicated state built with electrons and protons, but all you're really using is that the energies that you're liberating in any conductivity experiment are extremely small compared to the energies we're talking about. Even though there's this principle of energy in the rest mass of protons and electrons, because they're stable, it's the same argument as given before. You can imagine that all the only energy you can release, given the charges you've given, given that you've got an electron number and proton and baryon number 10 to the 23 in your system, the only energy you can release is the electromagnetic energies that are very, very small. So there's a consistent way to think of it. But for the purposes of what I'm doing, it's just think that it's impossible. All right, so nothing really interesting happened here. If you want light to scatter from light, it has to happen here. And that's going to have to be a dimension. This is dimension 6 because we have mass squared for each f and mass squared for the two derivatives. So we have to go to dimension 8. And at dimension 8, we can get something. So I'm going to put that over here. So effective minus 1 for z, mu. And since I've actually written the current in, I'm not going to just write it here now. So we would add this term minus t squared t1 minus 2a2 mu. And these coefficients have to have dimensions 1 over mass squared. Because those coefficients have dimensions 1 over mass squared. Because remember, this is mass to the 6, and so the whole thing would be surrounding the mass 4. A1 and A2 for the number of mass squared. So we're going to want to ask what that mass is eventually. And then dimension 8, with the things you can write down, you can use the same notation as I used here. And, let's be I'll give you another way of writing this where I don't have the epsilons in it. The second thing is just a different way of tracking things. So B and C are 1 over mass to the fourth. Because each F is mass squared, we've got a total of 4 of them because we've got 2 here and squaring it. So the whole thing had to be mass to the fourth, so these numbers could be 1 over mass squared.
So now that can't be written as a total derivative.
Right. And when you have two epsilon, you can always trade that with metric. So there's another way of writing that second term, which is like f nu, f nu lambda, f lambda rho, and rho. And then writing it that way, you see the total.
Yeah.
Okay. Writing it this way is a useful way to write it because if you're following the polarization of the photons, these things will see left and right circularly polarized photons. The combination of F plus or minus F dual is the thing that creates or destroys a particular polarization. So this is a useful way to do it when you're trying to do. So what we would do to calculate what C and D is we would calculate the amplitude for light, scattered light as a function of the circular polarization of a photon in the full theory, and we'll do it with this theory, and we can read off B and C are from those two experiments, the two kind of polarization of the light. So I'll just tell you what the answer is. So the first thing we have to do is, so far, I've just written down what the sum of Lagrangian is, but now we have the power count. So we could continue when we write down things that are higher dimension than this, have more derivatives, things like that. But this is a Lagrangian that is in a special case. It's in the category of Lagrangians that I power count already. So let's say that I because these are dimensions of 1 over mass squared, let me write this as being A1 is equal to alpha 1 over some m squared. A2 is alpha 2 over m squared. B is beta over m to the fourth. C is gamma over m to the fourth. So these things are dimensionless. And then the role of what I'm calling m here, if you look at what we have a Lagrangian which has got everywhere there's a field that has a derivative. When I did the power counting, I imagined that we had an f to the fourth in front of the whole Lagrangian. Powers of the field were counted by 1 over b, and powers of derivatives were counted by 1 over m. Here, everything can be counted by m, the way I'm doing it. So we can use the previous result. So an amplitude with d photons will be, just like before, it'll be f to the fourth, which is now m to the fourth, 1 over m to the e, which is 1 over b to the e. We had an m cubed over 4 pi m squared, so the 1 over m cancels, so 2l. And we have q over m to the 2 plus sum over e. And what we know in this case is that because everything is appearing in the combination F mu, every field we have always has a derivative of it. So we know that the number so we know that V N D is equal to zero unless D is bigger than or equal to N. You can't have more fields than derivatives because of gauge invariance, because of things that we build up by machine. Because A mu enters only the F sequence. So the power counting that I did before applies to this particular Lagrangian. So if we ask what's the leading contribution for light by light scattering, which is equals 2 to 4. Initially and finally, we would have that A4 goes like, we got 4 powers of 1 over m and 4 powers of m, that goes away. So q over 4 power m, 2l, and then q over m, 2 plus some. But we know that, so the things, if we think about what the example we did before, any interactions with two derivatives exactly drop under this power. So we can use those for free. To get the smallest answer possible, what we like to do is have no loops. So dominant piece. L equals zero. Then what we could have V and D equals zero unless D equals two. But if B equals 2, you can have B equals anything. But because we can't have more derivatives, fewer derivatives of fields, if we have D equals 2, then there, N has to be at most 2. So, but D equals 2 implies that N is equal to 2, basically. It's less than or equal to 2, but we know what we know all these things with the two derivatives and two or less fields, and the only thing we have is this. This is the only term we're interacting with D equals 2. So that wasn't an interaction, that was the kinetic term. So only the kinetic term. So that was the unperturbed Lagrangian that was giving you the propagator, not an interaction in the expansion of that integral that Simon Grassi is describing. So that means that all the interactions have defigured the two. And so you're always punished by at least one of these factors. So all vertices have at least, you know, the smallest number of derivatives we have is these ones where you have four. And so that means that we're going to get the smallest effect when we take exactly one vertex of D equals 4. This means small vertex of D equals 4. If D is equal to 4, then N has to be 4 or less. And then the only thing which had N less than 4 was for these terms which are priority weight. So the only things that appear at leading order are these two interactions. This one. So we had to do tree graphs because N is equal to 0 with these things. So the graphs are basically this. It's just each of those interactions has four external lines. So we're just doing this graph where we use the V vertex, and we add to it this graph using the C vertex. So that's the easiest graph to do. The cross section for photon-photon scattering, the function of angle, I'll just stay with the answer when you do that. You get (278/65 pi squared). As long as we get counted with this power coming, you get 2 d squared. Times the energy in the center of mass, 6th power, divided by nothing, times 3 plus cosine squared of the angle, means the photon squared. So the correction is that if we ask, what's the subleading piece? Subleading piece, if you repeat the argument and ask, what's the next biggest thing? You could be L equals 1. Not only it looks like it should be down by 2 more powers of q, but if you look at it, the thing that you would be trying to do is to draw a graph that doesn't exist. So the next the subdominant piece has got another 4 powers of energy in it. Plus order q over m. So if b and c, remember, go like 1 over m to the 4th, this would then beta squared plus gamma squared over m. If I use these definitions over here. And so on dimensional grounds, this should have been going like a cross section, which is a length squared. So it's 1 over an energy squared. And this is the right dimension, because there's energy to the six, but there's one of energy to the eighth. And so on dimensional grounds, given that you know that you're building an interaction which has a coefficient one over mass the eighth, mass the fourth n, and you can square the amplitude to get the cross-section, you can kind of predict that you're going to get an energy to the six. And the content is really at six extra angles. And what I've given you here is the unpolarized cross-section. And that's why these things appear. They appear in the combination of b plus I c squared plus b minus I c squared, basically. And this would have been the left-handed cross-section. This would have been the right-handed cross-section. And when I write those things out, I get the 2b squared plus c squared. May or may not be neither. So you're supposed to compare that to the result that you would have gotten from the full theory, but you only needed to do the calculation in the low energy limit. So in the full theory, this QEE, yeah, the only vertex is the one that has an electron coming in and coming out, and a photon goes off. And so if I add four photons scattering, the only way to do that is from the box graph. And if you calculate this, it gives you, in general, it gives you a complicated function of the energy. But if you go to the lowest energy, then it simplifies, and it becomes energy to the six. And it becomes .139 over 4 pi squared, alpha squared, 90 squared, 6, electron mass to 3 plus squared theta squared, plus you can kind of see where the alpha here is the fine structure constant of the d squared over 4 pi. So the amplitude had 4 factors of e in it. And so the rate will be the square of that and 8 factors of e. So that corresponds to 4 powers of alpha. So there's 4 powers of alpha. The pi's we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 powers of pi. That means there's going to be some pi's and then d's here. What we have to do is if I had done this for the polarized cross section, I could separately pick. Right now, all I can do is I play what b squared plus c squared is by comparing these two things. But if I'd done the polarization separately, I could have picked off b plus c and b minus c separately. So when you do that, find is the following. The thing that was non trivial here was that the energies and the angles, that all came out right. Right? You didn't have anything to play with there. And it had to come out. This is explaining kind of why this angular dependence and this energy dependence have to be there. It's much easier to do this calculation than it was to do that calculation. So if you wanted to know, the only thing that's hard to get from this is the normalization. And that number, 278 over 65, is easy to get with this calculation. It's harder calculation to do this one, and then take the learning one. But this comparison gives you what the coefficients are. So matchings will tell us that b is equal to 4 sevenths c, that's equal to alpha squared. So once I've done that, I want to write this in a thicker way than I do. So if I can put that back into the effect of Lagrangian, the interaction, that value of B and B was alpha squared over, this is the way you often will see it, 180 and e to the fourth plus 5 f mu squared minus 14 f mu lambda, lambda rho all I've done here is I've rewritten the FF dual. There's an identity which says that epsilon times epsilon is a bunch of metrics. I've used that to write.
Have you mentioned work there with the structure of 90 dimensions?
Oh, this is beta. So I had to ask if the M is like is ME. So all this tells you is yes. More coherent way to say that. And then E is this. E. It kind of had to be ME. The only thing in this loop was the electron mask. Given that you specified how many colors of energy you're looking at in the energy. If you might have been worried about whether or not this loop diverges, it happens it doesn't diverge. This is one of those graphs you just calculated, it's fine, I can get the answer, it's like humorous. So the beauty of this is that now at some level, once you have this, there's not a whole bunch of other observables you can use this for. But in principle, if you have other observables, now that you know that this coupling is, you can use this interaction for anything, and it's always the same size. And I can use it for something later on to do with neutrinos. So it will be useful to have done this once.
Could we distinguish B from C?
It's the whole two polarizations of the light. If you take it's B plus C gives you the left-handed polarization of the light, and the B minus C is the right-handed polarization. So if you imagine doing scattering, photon-photon scattering with the two different polarizations chosen, you'd have two independent amplitudes, which you could distinguish by looking at all possible polarizations in the scattering. So that's the principle.
Yeah, how we can get this coefficient force, this we have when our scattering just C squared.
That's because what I gave you there was the unpolarized rate. So I gave you the rate for the sum. That's what I meant there. But if we had done it, I didn't do this, but if I'd done it separately, then you would have basically just taken that square bracket, replace it with this or this, that would have been polarized rate. And what I didn't do is repeat the QD calculation for those two polarizations. That's the reason I didn't put it that way. But that has been done. So it's people picking critical parts intervals.
Questions? So you get a little F. Yeah, I don't know how much I have.
Dimension 6. Right.
So, but if you consider the rolling of the case properties, does this operation is still given up?
Yes, it depends on how you find the running, but I'm about to do that actually. That's what Z is going to be. Z is the result of the running of the cup. So I'm going to do that in detail. But the way I'm going to find the running, these things are irrelevant for it. You could choose to define running in a way in which you care about it, but it's something which will never appear in experiments for the reason I just gave.
Just I still get the running of the Riemann-Lenz coefficient of the case cap.
Yeah.
But the running of the coefficient of the current pump will be operated by the presence of this higher dimensional.
If you count the green functions, then they could be different. But if you so you could define a running coupling in terms of the Green's function of two electromagnetic fields as a function of Q squared, where Q squared is off shell, and then it would care. So that would depend on those coefficients. But if you then use those Green's functions to calculate anything physical, nothing would depend on that definition. Because in the end of the day, all the physical things, that Green's function I could change, but in field reduction. So it's a very specific way of normalizing the electromagnetic coupling. But it's not. There's no physical. There's no value in that choice as opposed to some other choice. So the following that thing around is kind of it's more work than you don't really need to follow it around. So it's normally convenient not to put that into normalization.
I just thought that if I effective case coupling by adding the magnetic pump to the LP.
Mm-hmm.
The physical heat coupling will depend on the momentum.
The physical one won't. It's, see, it depends on what you mean by physical. I would claim that you can take my definition and you can always add what you want to add, and no one can stop you. But when we go and calculate things, nothing will ever depend on the difference, physically. Even though intermediate steps will look like it, because if I look at the coupling, your coupling will be different from my coupling. But then they'll appear differently in all the answers in such a way, and it will look like a miracle if I get the same answer. And so that's why I gave the argument that the fact I can make yours into mine by doing a field definition shows you that they can't be different physically. And so it's the calculation may not, that may look mysterious if you kind of did the calculation explicitly, but when you finish, the definition you're talking about wouldn't have made any difference in the calculation you're doing, so you don't need to do it. So I'm going to choose not to do it. But you can choose to do it if you want. Okay. So the two things I want to say here were, first thing is, the scale that appeared here, you know, the M, is clearly the particle we integrated out. That's kind of not a surprise. That was the only dimension in the problem, given that the coupling was dimensionless. And so the E over M that's counting, you know, how low E has to be in this case, you know, because you know what the underlying theory is. If all you have is the effective theory, all you know is that this cross-section fails when the energy gets up to some scale M, and you wouldn't know what M was, unless you did the measurement of photon-photon scattering, and you numerically found out what these coefficients were. And then you can infer the value of M from that. But because you have no electrons in your theory, you wouldn't know what alpha was. So you just know you had some number here. And whether or not you couldn't figure out the electron mass from this calculation, all you can figure out is the ratio of alpha over m e squared. In the same way that in the weak interactions, the coupling that's describing neutrino interactions, it turns out to be related to the W boson U over root 2 is related to the W boson coupling in mass in a similar kind of a way. And you can measure this at low energies before you produce W bosons. That's what historically people did. But you don't know what the W boson mass is. You just know some combination of its coupling in mass. And the same thing is true here. It's a combination of coupling in mass that's there. And until you know the coupling, you don't really know exactly where the mass is. But you know kind of roughly what the scale is, given the coupling is 100, alpha is 10 to the minus 2. You're not going to be so far off if you had taken alpha to be 1. If you guessed what the mass was from the size of that coefficient. That's the first thing. If we had done the same thing for muons, the only difference at all would have been that ME would have everywhere been replaced by M mu. Right? And the alpha would have been the same because the charge and electron and muon are the same. So back at the very beginning, when we started off with this Lagrangian, which I'm probably not over here, this is the Lagrangian, this is the effective Lagrangian. When I wrote down this is the microscopic Lagrangian. I did not write the non-normalizable terms here that would have come from integrating out the muon. But if I had done that, one of the things that would be in this effective Lagrangian, if I think of this as not being the fundamental, pristine, normalizable theory of God, it's the thing that we got by integrating out the previous level of scales, muon in that case. There would have been a term here of the same kind of form. We would have had a term like minus alpha squared plus alpha squared over a mu to the fourth, 15 squared minus 14. So that term is there in the full in the theory of below the muon scale but above the electron mass. And so if we really asked to a high degree of accuracy what the result was down here, we would have had a contribution like the one we just found, but we would have had a similar one coming from this one would have gone along for the ride as well. This is contributing to photon scattering as well, because there's a similar box diagram where in the full theory of QED, the electron band muons, we have this graph of the electron, and we'd add to it the same graph of the muon in the full theory. And the effective theory knows that because there'll be a term coming from the muon that we get when we match from the theory above the muon mass to below the muon mass, and then we get to this thing when we match from above the electron mass to below the electron mass. So if we were working at that accuracy, we would have had a term like this. And you can see that you might worry that if you're identifying this coefficient, every charged particle that we have above this, the electron mass, is contributing in some level to this kind of a thing through a graph like this. Wouldn't that screw up your identification of the electron mass? The answer is no, because the lightest, because we're adding inverse powers of masses here, it's the lightest one that wins. So the fact that if this the ratio of this to this is basically the ratio of the electron mass, this divided by that is the ratio of the muon mass divided by the electron mass to the fourth power, which is like 10 to the 8th. So this is 10 to the minus 8 of that, of the electron piece. Because ME over MU is 10 to the minus 2. And there's four powers up there. So that shows you that when you're calculating this term, it's really the reason I didn't care about it up here was that I knew it wasn't going to make much difference down here, because it would only be relevant if I was trying to calculate things to an accuracy of a better than a part of 10 to the 8th. So if I wanted to know the cross-section, that accuracy, which is bigger than the subdominant piece here, right? This thing, if the energy, depending on what my energy is, this ratio could easily be much bigger than 10 to the minus 8. And I would have to calculate this in successive terms of this series before I ever got to the whatever MU terms. It's because those are small that we didn't need to really work with them here. At the lower energies. And that tells you that when you're looking for, if you identify the coefficient of a non-normalizable interaction like that, what you're identifying is not, it's in principle the sum of all the heavy things that could have contributed to the process you're looking at. But what's dominating that all the time is the lightest mass of the problem, because it's always, because it was non-normalizable, the mass was always in the denominator. So it's the smallest mass in the mean. So all of the things being equal. Now, the all other things equal part of that statement is important, because that says that, I told you already that if we had gone through this exercise and we described the weak interactions with neutrinos, that was being described by a coupling which had dimensions of inverse powers of mass, where the mass that appeared here in MW, we now know is something like 80 GeV. So in terms of MeV, which is what we were using, that's 80,000 MeV. Much, much bigger than any of the mass that we've been talking about so far. So you might have said that if I integrated out the electron and got an interaction involving neutrinos, that would be much bigger, that would typically go like something like alpha over Me squared. That would be much bigger than anything that you measure in the weak interactions. How could it possibly be that there's a contribution to neutrino interactions, which is as small as this, given that there's lots of lighter particles around that can be integrated out, and the lightest one should win. So there's the answer there is that all other things are not equal. There are selection rules in the weak interactions that are not, so symmetries that are broken in the weak interactions that electromagnetism doesn't break, like charge conjugation variance, things like that. And so typically, the processes that you measure weak interactions in were processes from which the contributions of electromagnetism and electrons were zero because there was a conserved quantity that forbade them. So you can see sometimes the influence of very high mass scales or comparatively high mass scales in effective interactions. And that's generically only when the lighter particles that are between that scale and the energies of interest to you, for some reason, were forbidden from contributing. If they could have contributed, then they would have contributed, and they'd be the biggest piece. So the burden is always when you're making a comparison like this to identify what's the lightest thing that has the quantum numbers to contribute to the process you're interested in. And I'm kind of flogging this because, for two reasons, tomorrow, or I guess next week, there's a story for neutrino scattering. Neutrinos eventually do talk to photons, if we look at non-normalizable interactions, because we know neutrinos talk to electrons. We know that there's reactions where the form neutrino-neutrino-electron-electron exists. So I can have an electron and a neutrino and I can scatter them from each other, and that's the measure. So if that happens, then I should be able to do quantum effects where the electron radiates photons and I can have photons scattered from neutrinos. There should be some rate for that. And we should be able to estimate what it is and how it depends on energy. And there's a surprise there, because you might have thought that the neutrino neutrino goes to photon, photon, or neutrino, photon goes to neutrino, photon. You might have thought that was the biggest, that should be the biggest cross section, because if we had more photons, it should cost me more electromagnetic couplings. And so I think the cross section for radiating many photons should be always smaller than the cross section for having the fewest number of photons. And that turns out to be false. And that may, and because, for an interesting reason, the neutrinos, this process, there's a selection rule which says that this, the amplitude for this goes like 1 over, it goes basically like 1 over m weak to the fourth power. Whereas the amplitude for you can stick one more photon in, and you can get an amplitude which goes like 1 over m weak squared, 1 over m electron squared. You had to have 1 over m weak somewhere to, because this parity is broken, and electromagnetic can't do that. But once you've got it once, you can pay a loop of electromagnetic interactions and get electron mass out of it, which is a bigger effect than you can from this. And so it happens that if you were able, if you could ever do this, and no one has been able to do it in practice, you could measure photon neutrino scattering. Neutrinos should prefer to scatter with two photons in the final state rather than one, because of the argument I'll give you next on this. And so, and the lesson of that argument is this lesson, that that all other things equal is important. You have to ask what particles have the selection rules to contribute to processes, and this will be an example where something interesting happens in that case. But once you have particles that contribute, the lightest one will win. And so if you, when we go to gravity, this, I'm saying this because the gravity's come up a number of times in the class. When you're looking at the corrections, the effective interaction with gravity, typically gravity doesn't break any selection rules. Gravity is the friendliest force you ever have. And so all of the things are equal in the gravity case, and so if I do a loop like this with electrons and gravitons on the outside, I get contributions through gravitational processes, and so the lightest particle in that case is the electron. So you often see the statement that if I looked at the effective theory for gravity, it would be Einstein's theory plus corrections, you know, R squared, let's say, plus R cubed, plus da-da-da, and maybe put the gradient of Planck's square. And that's almost certainly true. There's a term like that, but there's a bigger one, which is an electron, which comes from a graph like this, where an electron goes around the loop and radiates gravitons. And so the scale, if you asked in the solar system, where would you expect the predictions of Einstein's gravity to start contributing? It's going to be when the energy involved in your process or the distances involved are long compared to some scale. What is that scale? It's not the Planck scale. It's typically the electron scale. It's a much longer scale than you might have thought if you had not been careful. So that'll all come out in this thing. There's nothing, no class this afternoon. I have to go back to Hamilton. But next week will be a regular week. So there'll be a class in the morning. So I didn't take a break, but this means you can get lunch before the students arrive. Actually, nobody's mine.